back, everyone, to Out of the Main. This is the first interview of season 5, so very excited to do this one, John. For more than one reason, you know what the other reason is.
Do we even the score today? Bass players to drummers? We've been keeping a rough tally. We do, right?
We did, yep.
So, right.
We have to welcome our guests. We're evening the score with my brother and co-host here. Mm-hmm. But let's bring him on, John, without further ado, shall we?
What are you scoring exactly? Aggression or intellect?
Neither.
Just quantity.
Quantity. I'm a drummer at heart, and Tom's a bass player at heart, and we've had drummers on, and we had the drummers had the lead for a while, and now we're up. The bass players have finally caught up.
Yeah, roaring comeback. Thanks to today's guest, Neil Steubenhaus, who listeners to this podcast will recognize that name. It's been uttered many, many times. But for those who have just tuned in for the first time, we have somebody who has performed on more than 600 albums, of which more than 70 have been nominated for Grammys, and more than 20 Grammy-winning songs, and the bassist on 60-plus gold or platinum albums. This is incredibly our honor to welcome Neil Steubenhaus. How you, Neil? Thank you for coming on the show.
Happy to be here.
Great. Well, what's keeping you busy these days? We follow you on Facebook, and my heart was a flutter. I told you off air that we saw a picture of you with John Robinson, and it was, I thought, a session. So are you out there recording?
That was a session, 2 days of sessions. I think I sent you his name. The memory is not as good as it was when I was 40. Really nice guy who writes his own songs, and I think could afford to have the best musicians, and he hired Greg Phillinganes to do. We did 4 tunes or 5 or 6, but 4 that we all played on, and it was kind of thrilling to get, you know, be in the same room with musicians again. The overdubbing and the tracking, you know, via digital it's not really my thing. Not because I don't want to keep active and make some money doing it, but it's not fun, and I'm not that good at it. My talent, I always thought, was very specific, which is that I'm influenced by whatever I hear around me, and I come up with what I play in the moment, and it has to be inspired by the music and the quality of the music and the quality of musicianship, and if it's in my wheelhouse musically, which kind of eliminates, you know, certain genres, heavy metal or what have you. There's other guys that are much better at that, and that's what I do. So it's not fun to me being in that room with Greg and Dean and Tarek and JR and Kevin, the percussionist. It's thrilling to me. The music can be, you know, not the next Steely Dan. It doesn't really matter. Greg makes it great because he's a genius, and everybody that I just listed, they're brilliant. They just, you know, it's 2 takes max. I'll put it that way. We run it down a little bit, and then by the second take, it's perfected. So that's what could be better than that. I grew up on that. And I'm not used to all this other nonsense of playing something 20 times from a track and overdubbing on it and making it. And everybody's already used to what they had from a computer or another bass part. And very rarely do they say, just go and then hear what I do, and don't influence me by another bass track. And if they let me go, I'll do my best. If the song really brings in, you know, creativity, if it's, you know, not anything that thrills me or it doesn't make sense, I'm not good at it. There's other players, I think, that are better at that.
So I was looking at your roster of, you know, artists you've played with, and I can only touch on a few of them, but what interested me about it was the range of calls that you got back in the day, and then the ones that you worked with, you know, very regularly. So, you know, we've got Gino Vannelli, we've got many Streisand records, which I want to ask about. Quincy, of course, has called you. I saw your name on Juice Newton records, so a little different thing there. Anita Baker, George Benson, John Klemmer, the jazzy thing, Neil Diamond, the more easy listening thing, and Clint Black, True Country. The question that came to mind with all of that is, do you see yourself then as sort of a chameleon type of bass player that you can go into those different genres and fit in? Or is it more the case that your sound, your style, just fits with these other people and you don't have to necessarily adjust what you do? You know what I mean? Do you mentally take on a new persona when you go into these other styles, like a Juice Newton or a Clint Black, say?
Not really, but you adjust to everything. You adjust to everything a little bit. You read the room. You want to see if, you know, the first thing you see is, are they looking for simplicity? You know, like you work with a guy like Peter Cetera that I worked with years ago, and he's such a simple player and a simple thinker that I automatically kind of figure no extra notes. No, or as Miles would say, no butter notes. You know, just don't do it, whatever that ever really meant. You always read the room, but my first instinct is to give them everything I got that is me. And I can tell pretty quickly if they don't want that, you know, if that's too much, or you never know. Sometimes they're just thrilled. I mean, I played on so many sessions in the early days where they told me nothing. Or they passed out a chart that had a baseline that looked just either boring or dated or wrong to me. And my first instinct is ignore it. So I go into the session, I play something completely different. And if they light up with a smile and say, wow, that is awesome. Or they say, that's way wrong, stick to the paper. Then you refresh your thinking and you start, you know, and you play it. I mean, I had been in sessions years ago. Diana, what was the blind artist? Diane Schur. And I went instinctively, played what I thought was good. The arranger hated it. He said, play the notes on the paper. I started playing the notes on the paper. He hated it. The producer stepped right in and said, let Neil do Neil. And I'll make the long story short. It was great, and he was wrong, and he ended up being a teacher at Berkeley 30 years later, and my daughter was a student there, and he told her the story that I embarrassed him and that he had written blah blah. I changed it. We had a little confrontation about it. The producer was Andre Fisher. He stepped in and said let Neil play Neil. And and he realized that, you know, he's a great arranger, and I'm an instinctive bass player. I'm not John Patitucci or any of these, Carlito. I can't play that kind of fancy stuff. I don't do that. I just play what I hear and feel and try to keep it as simple as possible and add a little bit of personality to it. And that's the long and short of the answer to your question. Is that, you know, everybody's different and you have to read the room. And sometimes you go left and they didn't want that. And sometimes you go right, they didn't want that either. They went straight ahead. So you read it.
You mentioned Berkeley. That's a name that comes up a lot on our podcast as well. So John actually is also a graduate of Berklee College of Music. So my understanding is you graduated in 75, I think. And from what I read, there is where you met Vinnie Caluta and John Robinson, is that right?
And Steve Smith and Mike Stern and
Jeff Lorber
and Jeff Richman and Bill Frizzell and a million great play. I mean, it's really astounding from that particular class. I did not graduate. My bass teacher that I was assigned to. After I switched from an upright major to electric, and Gary Burton brought Steve Swallow into the fold and Pat Metheny, you know, then everybody, of course, Steve Swallow and I became good friends. Reminds me, I have to email him. And not close friends, but we talked more than I barely played the instrument. He took a liking to me and started sending me to all of his ensembles when he left and going on the road with Gary Burton. So that was my second year of school. And the third year, Steve was leaving, and Steve told the bass department, Neil should be the teacher that replaces me. There were 40 applicants. I think the fix was in. I never asked. The fix was in. It was me. Swallow said Neil, and the applicants were all kind of, I mean, fair or not, I would default to not. But I got the job, and I started teaching there, and I was no longer a student, so I never graduated. I went 2 years, and I taught, and then I taught for 2 years. And the 2 years that I taught, they didn't really have an electric bass player specialist. They had upright players who played electric, so they were guessing. So I was really the first one. I broke the ground on electric being, you know, and Stanley was hot. Jaco was just starting to show up with Pat. They'd come to town. We became friends. And that was kind of the Berkeley connection. So all the students by the second semester all switched to me, all the electric bass players. And we studied Jaco and we studied Stanley and we studied, you know, all those things that were brand new and fresh and incredible. But that's my Berkeley story. I taught for 2 years. And I was a student for 2 years. They gave me an alumni, whatever that is, award, you know.
That's cool. Wow. I would say you sort of did graduate. If you get right from, you know, go work from student to teacher.
I mean, you can't learn how to play at Berkeley, in my opinion. You need to know how to play. You need to be really good and get better at playing, but not learn how to play from nothing. Everyone who wanted to learn how to play took lessons with Charlie Benakis, who was down the street off of Comm Ave, and everybody studied with him. They were playing John Steps in 6 months.
Wow.
You don't really, so at Berkeley, you kind of learn at the time, it's all different now, but you learn what if music is for you. And if you stay, then you learn all big band and orchestration and the real serious music stuff, which seems to be absent from the world these days, thanks to some politics back in the 80s that killed arts in the schools. There's no music in schools anymore.
Yeah.
Everybody thinks Taylor Swift's a genius.
reserve comment because I have nieces and nephews. Well,
she's a great entertainer, and she writes a lot of good songs that appeal to age groups. And I'm in awe of her for what she's accomplished, and anyone else who's writing music, you know, who actually has a bridge to the song, you know,
Someone else just said that to us. That exact same thing about a bridge. I forget who it was.
Was it Don Brightup?
Don Brightup. Yeah. It was Don.
It's anybody.
Yeah.
Listen to any song now.
Right.
There's no bridge.
I know.
Nobody knows how to write music. If I'm going to point a finger, I would combine the fact that there's no arts in schools is tragic and criminal to me because people think those are the top artists. And I blame you too. Because they were the first group that was same four chords for the verse, the same four chords for the chorus, no bridge. People made fun of Steely Dan. What did that tell you?
Right. Yeah.
You're making fun of the most brilliant, you know, one of the most brilliant songwriting team in rock and roll and executed. You know, add Sting and add you know, all the great songwriters. There's never no bridge. Right. Listen to every Beatle tune. Every bridge in every Beatle tune is brilliant. It diverts from the basis of the song lyrically and musically. It could change key. It does anything. And that's a real song. Every Beatles song, every single Beatles song is a real song, a well-written song. And then went down the line. And all those songwriters are great. I mean, I worked for Bacharach at least 50 times or more. Songs are genius. Everything, and there's always a bridge.
Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower than low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
You mentioned Steely Dan, because the question I had teed up is, how do you then, just give us the history from your teaching in Berkeley to eventually you become this prolific session player in LA. How did you get from one to the other?
Luck and timing. I mean, you know, anyone who tells you that it was just pure talent, you still have to have, the luck is having, if you have instincts, then you're lucky to have good instincts. It's not I don't know the environment that creates that, whether it's, you know, upbringing and parenting and your environment. But my instinct was just, you know, like a lot of the musicians who made it further, is take everything, play with everybody, just keep doing it. You know, I didn't go to Berkeley to learn how to play. I already knew how to play. I went to Berkeley to be in a town that had a condensation of a zillion musicians and there's no work. So that's money. Money and work is not the name of the game. And all these people come to LA and go to Musicians Institute or whatever, they get fixated on the world of work around them and they see it. It's not their fault, but they see it. And the questions I used to get asked in the 80s was, how do you become a studio musician? And my first instinct is, well, get out of here. Learn how to play. I don't know what to say. I didn't know what to say, because you have to have the instincts to interpret everything and be wide open. So how did I get here? A couple of steps along the road. I met a lot of great musicians in Boston. I was playing and teaching, and Mike Stern called me and said, they just fired the bass player in Blood, Sweat, and Tears, which happened a lot, frankly. And Jocko did it for a couple of months, and he recommended me, and they hired somebody else, and he didn't get along with somebody. I don't really know the backstory. So Mike calls and he says, the first gig is Saturday. It was like a Wednesday. Oh, okay. You know, here they're playing, boop, boop. Where are we rehearsing? We're not rehearsing. Okay, fine. So I got to some gig with them, and it went on for 8-9 months, and I just played, and they loved me. They never told me ever what to play, ever. And I was spoiled by that. I always have been, because I don't take directions that well if I don't think that they're helpful. So Blood, Sweat, and Tears led to the band disbanded because the sax player OD'd in Amsterdam and died, and the band just stopped for I don't know how long. Went back to Boston. The drummer called me. He said, we're going on a little tour with Gap Man Joan. Gap Man Joan is Chuck's older brother, plays piano, and they assign. And Chuck got Gap a deal on A&M because Chuck was on A&M. Larry Carlton was assigned to produce Gap's record. So Larry produces Gap. I go on the road with Gap, with Bobby Conomo, the drummer, and Mike Stern. Mike and Gap get along as well as oil and water. And that ends like that. We did 1 week and Mike hated, they didn't get along. So Gap books another gig in Denver, and I get to Denver, and it's Carlos Rios on guitar and Tommy Campbell, a drummer from who I knew at Berkeley, on drums. And that's the band. And Carlos is mind blowing. This is 78. And Carlos is just mind blowing of a guitar player. And the sweetest guy on the planet. And we did a week there, opening up for Bill Cosby. Nicest guy I ever met. Not. And Carlos said, you know, Larry Carlton, who's kind of my idol, is putting a band together to tour his first record. He said, and I think you should audition for the band. So I said, yeah. So our last gig of that little mini tour was at the Roxy in LA on Sunset Boulevard. So that Larry came to the gig because he produced Gap's record, and he wanted to, it was a Saturday night and I was booked to go home on Sunday, and Larry put a jam session together with me and John Ferraro, Greg Matheson, and Larry at Larry's house on Sunday. I auditioned, flew home to Boston. And he called me and he said, you got to move to LA. I want you to join the band. And he had auditioned all the guys that were whoever in LA. And I said, and I was already shopping New York because I had already met, you know, the Brecker brothers and Dave Sanborn and all these people who said, you got to move to New York. So I'm looking it around and it's looking frightening to me. Just the idea of being there and getting used to the city. And when Larry hired me, he had a friend who was buying up real estate because real estate was cheap back then for rental. And his friend, who I had met years ago in Vegas, named Willie Ornelas. Willie had replaced Jeff Porcaro with Sonny and Cher. So Willie's in Vegas. I'm in Vegas with Little Anthony and the Imperials. I meet Willie. He's got a house. I spend 10 minutes meeting Willie and looking at the place when I went to LA real quick to just find a place. And boom, I took it. So I moved to LA and I go on the road with Larry. That's the transition.
You had a quote in one of your interviews about that, getting to LA, and you you said the big shock of my career was getting to LA, meeting Jeff Porcaro, and changing my entire outlook on music, realizing how brilliant these guys were out there. So what about meeting Jeff and getting in with that those West Coast musicians? What changed your outlook?
Well, here's the background. Background is I'm an East Coast guy. I'm hanging around with Steve Smith and Vinnie Colaiuta, and we're listening to, you know, the newest Miroslav Vitas record. You know, we're listening to the Miles records that go back to Tony Williams and everything, and we're just fascinated with growing musically because all that stuff was 1,000 miles more advanced than your average rock and roll or what have you, and that was our world. But all the records I looked at, Brecker Brothers records lead you to, you know, you see Steve Gadd, Harvey Mason, you see, I mean, Harvey actually didn't count because he was LA, but you see Steve and you see Willie and Anthony Jackson and Chris Parker and the players that are New York. And that's all you think is that these are the guys. They're playing the creative stuff. It's advanced. It's not the simple stuff, but you're ignoring the West Coast, which is Boss Skaggs. But everybody loved that stuff. Those are the tunes we're playing, you know, on the gigs, playing music for the everybody's, and it's good stuff. But I'm never looking at the credits because there's nothing that jumps out at me like listening to Gadd and Anthony Jackson playing together, which is just mind blowing. So that's where we're all going. We're all going to the advanced stuff and ignoring the West Coast. And so I wasn't paying attention to it. My bad, but I caught it in time. But when I get to LA and I realize all these, I don't even know their names. I didn't know Jeff's name. I didn't know anybody. I never looked at the names of the records because everything sounded not just perfect, but nothing stood out to me. I wasn't thinking like that. And I got there and things fell in place. I started doing some television dates that Larry turned me on to with Mike Post. And in those Mike Post sessions, I walk in and there's Victor Feldman playing vibes. Victor Feldman. And I'm looking at it like this, are you kidding me? And the players that were taking sessions, you know, I'm looking around and then there's Tom Scott in the horn section, who I knew about and others. It was, and Pete Chrisleave and these guys that were on the records. And it was mind boggling to see this. They're all making a living going to these, playing Magnum PI for an hour and a half. You know, seriously, one after another, the Rockford Files. I mean, I wish I could have saved the music sheets that I had, but we're blowing this out at 8:30 in the morning and leaving at 11. And you're never going to hear it again. You're going to watch a television show. If you can hear the music over the car or the motorcycle, then good luck. But you know, they perfect everything on television. We perfected and moved on. You know, it doesn't matter whether it was Chips or the Dukes of Hazzard. It's still in the words of Tim May, it was a giant pad for a car solo.
Ha ha ha!
We perfected everything on Dukes of Hazzard week after week. And when you watch it on TV, it's a car solo. It's vroom, 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 with music in the background with Larry McNeely playing these brilliant banjo solos and JD playing these steel solos. It's insanely great. You'll never know. You never know. So the reason I mention that is because Tom Scott heard me, didn't say a word. He heard me on one of those sessions. And I got a phone call. I went on the road with Seals and Crofts. I met the guys when we opened up for them with Larry Carlton. And I was doing just a couple of weekend gigs with them. And my wife calls and she says, Tom Scott just called. He needs you at the studio tomorrow with Richard T. and Steve Gadd. My heart's pounding.
Wow.
So I call him and I say, I'm in San Francisco. I have a gig. I can't go. He said, all right, we'll catch you next time. There goes my career. It was over. It was over. I just blew it.
Yeah.
And you got to be right there. When lightning strikes, you got to be right where the lightning's going to strike if you want to get burnt. So he did call back. And a few weeks later, I went to the studio and I got there and there's Jeff sitting there, minding his own business, just getting sounds, just playing a simple beat. And the session was about 9 to 12 hours long. We went tune to tune. We actually changed the songs entirely. And that's the moment that you're asking about. I connected with that. And it was like the sun coming out. This is what they're talking about. The simplicity and the musicality was beyond brilliant. It was indescribable. And that's the long answer to your short question.
Well, go ahead, John.
Well, you go ahead.
I have a follow-up because
I did something completely different. So, go ahead.
Because you mentioned Jeff Porcaro. I mean, if you look at all of the names that you've played with, it's literally everybody, right? So as a former bass player is probably the best way to say it myself. I played with...
I see it right back there.
I still have it. Yeah, it doesn't play anymore. No,
sure it does.
That's the definition of a bass player, myself included. We own a bass.
That's right. Exactly. So I've noticed that there's certain drummers that you drum with or that you play with that the groove is just instinctive and it's magic and it's not even really work. And then there's others where you just, I can't make this happen with this guy. So since we know some of the names, if you're willing to divulge, is there a guy or two that you just clicked with automatically and it just was the perfect fit for you and your style?
Yeah, for the most part, most of them. I mean, Jeff is going to be number one, but that ended tragically in the 90s. Or 89, I can't even remember what year it was. That ended. John Robinson, Vinny. I mean, I really tried to help push Vinny break into the studio world because Vinny had a reputation of being, you know, too good. And arguably, you know, it was an adjustment to learn the simplicity that I don't have those kinds of jazz chops. So Vinny has every chop in the world. So those are the magic guys, you know, Jeff and Vinny. And I connected with I really connected with Harvey Mason on a lot of things. Not necessarily every record that wasn't necessarily up either of our alleys, but for the most part, when we were just fooling around together, we did the Academy Awards for a couple of decades. And the music that we played during the breaks that nobody heard was sensational. And I always jammed with Harvey. So a lot of them, you just connect. And if it's just musical, you know, then you can't beat it. But Jeff is the one who clued me into that. And I did great before I got to, I connected with most of the drummers I played with before I got, you know, in the studios too. They're all good. You know, you just have to really, when you're playing music that you both like, it's easy. If you're interpreting a song or a piece of music that you never heard before and it's not 100% intuitive and in your wheelhouse, that's where it's more challenging. Some drummers, you know, and bass players connect more than others for that matter.
You probably had to have sort of a realization or a learning curve that you realize that those musicians on those records that you know, I'll say ignore in quotes because you didn't intentionally do that. But when you got out there and actually started playing with them, you realized how much chops they had to sort of keep in the locker in order to be able to play on these pop records. Because, you know, the producers wanted boom, bap, and, you know, they didn't want jazz chops on a Streisand record, right? So you learned that these guys were that capable, but there was an art to doing it in this context.
It's not necessarily keeping the chops in the locker deliberately. It's we're musicians. This is the music. This is the song. And this is what it calls for. You're a good musician and you have the instincts, or you think it's about you. It's not. I mean, you know, and I'll leave names out, but, you know, there were bass players who were really accomplished players who really wanted to break in to make a living. And they'd call me and ask me to recommend them. And nobody realizes in the 80s, the business doesn't work like that. Recommendation is very rare from any player turning down a session and saying, you should hire so-and-so, because you're not speaking to the people who are hiring anyway. If I get a phone call in the 80s, it's an answering service. Are you available for this and such at 10 a.m.? No, I'm no good on that. Okay, they have a list. They have seven people. That's how I broke in. I was number seven. So everybody broke in. They're number seven, they're number eight, or number 10. And they go down the list, and everybody's working. So boom, that's the default. And then they make a discovery if they like you, and lists start to fluctuate. That's kind of the way the whole thing works, like in life. So it's musical instincts. To answer your question, it's really instincts. It's not about the chops. If this ballad calls for this amount of whole notes, your instincts tell you, there's the intro, don't play. First verse, do I play or do I add a note? Maybe don't start off not playing. If it sounds like you're supposed to play, play some whole notes, half notes, something like that. A high note, enter. First chorus, play. Get it going. Don't play fancy. Nothing fancy. It is not about you. It's the song. So you're servicing the song, no matter how you slice it. Think of a restaurant. You know, they want the people to love their food. They'll make little adjustments. They'll do whatever they need. Oh, you want it medium rare? You want it, you know, you want this. You want the sauce on the side. So you're thinking the same way. You're servicing the song and you're making the song great.
And we interrupt this podcast to bring you this commercial break. Actually, it's not a commercial break. It's just a break. All right. Well, as we so often do, we get to talking to these fine musicians and we lose track of time. So we got to break into two episodes, which we're going to do again today. So we will take a break now, get to our lightning round part A, and then conclude our conversation with Mr. Neil Steubenhaus next week.
Lightning, fire.
Woo, doggy.
Okay.
All right. So, found at sea.
You got one?
I do.
Okay.
The one thing I just wanted to point out to people, which we can't cover on this podcast, is do your research into Neil's vast catalog, because there's a lot there. Mm-hmm. And it's a lot of different kinds of styles. So I'm not going to go into all of that today. But what was interesting is one of which is being found at sea. Remember when Kenny Rogers was found at sea? And a lot of the...
What do you mean?
Well, let me explain.
Okay.
That 1986 album produced by Jay Green. Yes. So it's trying to be yachty. It's 1986, so it's a little after the fact.
Imitative. But
a lot of the yacht rockers love that album.
Really?
So, yeah. not the rockers, but the yacht rock, you know, fans amongst the audience. So anyways, it's not exactly on the mark for me, but I do like certain things about it. So I wanted to point to the album's called They Don't Make Them Like They Used To, which is true. And Neil Steubenhaus plays on the title track, which was written by Burt Bacharach, Carol Bayer Sager, and it sounds like this. However, the reason I wanted to bring up that album, because talk about being found at sea. So I'm looking at this, who's writing all these songs, and you've got Randy Goodrum, and you've got Jay Graydon himself, but track three called You're My Love is written by Joey Coco. I'm like, who's Joey Coco?
I know where this is going.
Click on the link. And Joey Coco is a synonym for, or sorry, a pseudonym for...
It's got to be Prince, right?
It is Prince.
Okay.
So Prince has been found at sea on more than one occasion.
He has.
Yep. Certified yacht rocker Prince. That's how I refer to him.
I wonder what time of night Neil had to record those bass parts with Jay at the helm.
Yeah, good question. Yep. All right. What have you found at sea?
Well, I went looking and decided to just do a quick search and see what came up if I posted in search Neil Steubenhaus's greatest bass lines or something to that effect. And I found in one of the forums, I don't think it was Talk Bass Forum, which I know listener Mike likes. It was another one. But anyway, several people had commentary. Most of them were things that maybe we already knew or talked about. But this one caught my attention. And the guy gave a little bit of write-up, and he said, this is like maybe he's a music critic. But beginning with a main theme based on the root, fifth, and sixth, Steubenhaus is playing exhibits both precision and groove. He plays with an articulate attack during the verses with short notes to add a bounce-like feel to the song. Opening up during the choruses, he extends the length of his notes, adding slides and accents, and he gracefully leads the band through the changes. I like that. While the tonality of this record is quite a departure from the Temptations' classic Motown sound, it certainly is not lacking a sense of groove and dignified bass playing. This is Temptations 1986, and he's not kidding when he said it doesn't sound like the Motown sound. The album was called To Be Continued, and the song he was talking about is called You're the One. Yeah, there's Neil with the Temptations, well, such as it is.
Yeah, and it, like I said about his catalog earlier, and you brought up during the interview, is that he is able to be a chameleon and kind of jump around into different sounds and genres.
So. There were some extra personnel of note on that. I should point out that Paulino Da Costa on percussion, Dan Huff is on guitar. I can't tell because it doesn't have track by track. It's either Vinnie Caliuta or J.R. Robinson on drums. Sounds like J.R. to me. And it's mixed by Mick Gazowski of Chuck Mangione and Daft Punk era.
Yeah.
All right.
Buried Treasure.
Moves us into Buried Treasure. Well, I don't feel like we quite delved into the Streisand connection enough with him, right? Well, because there was obviously she is not Yachty. Obviously, she is not even a rocker. But the session musicians and the producers brought her along at times, even though her vocal styling still sound a lot like, I can't get like her singing Cats out of my head. You know what I mean? It all sounds very Broadway.
Yes. You should hear her sing My Favorite Things at Christmas time.
Yes. Ooh. But not this one. This one has obviously Neil on bass. Let's see. Jay Graydon and Jeff Baxter are your guitar players. Bill Payne on piano. Let's see, who else? Greg Matheson is the arranger and keys player. It's written by Bruce Roberts and Paul Jabara, who I don't know. But this is her doing a disco duet with Donna Summer, and there's some wicked bass in this. This is No More Tears, Enough Is Enough.
I can't go on. No more, no. Enough is enough. I won't hear.
So did you expect to find any real pure disco in Neil's catalog? I did not.
Well, now I don't know what to expect because I'm discovering that he's everywhere all at once.
Here, there, and everywhere.
Yep. So far we've had some sort of yachty-ness. We've had the Temptations, which kind of Motown. Now we're at disco. I'm going to bring us into more of a country realm.
Ooh, okay.
Because my buried treasure is the album, the rest of the catalog that you don't know about Joey Scarberry beyond...
Mm.
Yeah, Greatest American Hero, which has come up before on this podcast, but I think the album is so worth delving back into that I wanted to delve. And it just so happens that Neil Steubenhaus plays bass on this record.
He does.
However, so does...
Lee Sklar.
Lee Sklar.
And you don't know who's who. They don't tell you song by song.
They don't tell you song by songs. I'm going to guess and hope that he played bass on the song. If he didn't, good job to Lee Sklar. This is called When She Dances.
When she dances, like the wind in the long, tall grass. When she dances, she's got so much soul. She can make you forget everything you're thinking of, and she can make you fall in love when she dances.
Oh, that album is a buried treasure.
The entirety of it, yes.
It's all good, every bit.
Yep.
What's your guess? Is that Lee or is that Neil?
If I had to guess, I might go the other way and think Lee.
Okay. I'm saying Neil. Okay. So Neil, send us a message. Or if anyone knows, hit us up in the comments, as they
please
say. All right. I'm going to let you go first on final thought, because I want my final thought to be the final thought.
You're kind of pinching me into a corner here. Well, because mine is going to have to do... I told you that this season may have some more cliffhangers to come.
Oh,
we started we ended last season with a cliffhanger. We're moving into more cliffhanger territory. So at the end of this first episode with Neil, we were talking about how his transition from New York persona, not just learning, but all the stuff he was listening to, the heavy fusion stuff, the Jaco stuff, you know, Chick Corea, and all this other super challenging stuff. And the stuff that was coming out of the West Coast at the time to him wasn't making any impression on him. He just, as he said, nothing really stood out to him. It wasn't until he got to LA and started getting into some of these sessions and playing with these guys. And what would happen when the session was over, and there was still some time left, the guys hadn't torn down yet, and they would just jam together. And he's like, ooh, these guys can play, right?
Yes, sir.
So I'd asked him about keeping that stuff in the locker.
Mm-hmm.
And then, you know, realizing now that there was a place where you could keep all of that stuff under reins, but still use some of your special sauce that maybe you picked up from Jaco or whoever to enhance your playing. And he expounded on that. And I sort of had a contrary opinion to the way he answered the question. So I'm going to leave it there. Next week, come back. I hit him with a counter argument to what he said, and then you'll get to see how he responds and whether he stormed out of the interview or not.
Well, we know he didn't.
Not necessarily.
We'll find out. Yes, that's why it's a cliffhanger.
Could be an extra long lightning round next week.
I'm picking up on what a cliffhanger is now. Okay, for my final thought, funny little stories. I had all this stuff selected because I wanted to showcase Neil's slap bass a little bit, because he doesn't do it a lot.
Mm-mm.
And I either lost my notes or I never took down the notes, and I just had open tabs on a browser that I was planning to come back to. And now I'm like, oh, what was it? So I'm racking my brain. I resort to emailing Neil. I'm like, Neil, send me some of your slap bass. He's like, there's not really a whole ton of it, but he sends me a couple tunes, one of which is a Tom Scott song. And I'm like, that's it.
Yeah.
But it wasn't that Tom Scott song. I remember listening to Tom Scott's Flashpoint album.
Right. You even brought it up at one point, I think.
I did. Also from 1986.
Yeah.
And I'm like, this is the tune I want to play. So here is a little of Coast to Coast. So then I come to find out, for some reason, I'm going through an old text thread, and it turns out that listener Mike sent that song to us back in November of 2022 to listen to. So
prior to our research. So yeah, it fell on deaf ears because you didn't have context. Now you do.
Well, I did, but I guess it's turning 52, or, you know, in the brain, the memory's not all there. But
so is this Found at Sea, Buried Treasure, or Final Thought?
This is my final thought, because now I'm going to allow Mr. Neil Steubenhaus to have the final thought, and let's let him play out Coast to Coast.
Ahoy, ploy.